Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to another episode of Voices for Excellence. I am your host, Dr. Michael Connor, CEO and founder of the Agile Evolutionary Group, and of course, the proud host of VFE. And today's guest is a superintendent that I admire. We met when we were working on a collaboration with the Leadership Development Council of America, where we're preparing leaders or potential future leaders in their leadership trajectory. And I have just admired her work. And then all of a sudden, just through evolution and through talking, we find out we have a myriad of the same friends and colleagues across the country. But just after doing extensive research on her and just knowing her and like, who am I partnering with within this Leadership Development Council? And just her resume and what she's done in education have just been absolutely extraordinary. She is the past president of the Illinois ALAS and also the current superintendent of Forest Park School District 91, just outside of Chicago, Illinois. It is my absolute honor to have Dr. Elizabeth Alvarez on Voices for Excellence. You are going to be in for a treat this episode with to my listeners and viewers. So Dr. Alvarez, hello, how are you, my friend? How's everything?
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening to everyone out there. And then Dr. Connor, where have you been all my life? It's like, how did that happen?
Oh, it's like Dr. Alvarez, it is literally, it's my audience and viewers. Before we came on, Dr. Alvarez and I, we have been meeting, I would say over the past like 4 months per se, right? And we've always talked, you know, we leadership theory, practices, how we're going to really cultivate leadership trajectory in education. And then we just started talking like, oh, wow, yeah, we have some of the, how do we, mutual friends, how do we not engage with each other over the course
passing ships
of many years?
You were that one person I saw at a conference just walking on by to go get his lunch.
Exactly. I just waved to you. Didn't know who you were, wait, but I am so glad you're in my life, Dr. Alvarez. Just absolutely a joy. Thank you for coming on VFE. I promise it's not rigorous. I promise it is a leadership. It's a leadership podcast. But the All questions right. want to be hard because I want my audience and my viewers to see the level of expertise that you have, Dr. Alvarez, that I engage with on a biweekly basis for our leadership council that we're on. So are you ready, Dr. Alvarez?
Let's do it. Let's do this.
So, Dr. Alvarez, even though we didn't encounter with each other that much over the course of, I like to say, 3 or 4 years, but the 4 months, you know, but for education leaders and stakeholders who don't know your leadership work as the past president and current member of the Illinois ALAS or your current role as superintendent in Forest Park, just outside of Chicago that I stated earlier, I'm interested in knowing this, Dr. Alvarez. What song describes your leadership signature and the AC stage of education, and AC stage of education meaning after COVID-19?
You know, if you were to ask me this prior to COVID-19, it would be Staying Golden by Scott, you know. Mm-hmm. But as I think about this now, the song that I'm going to choose. Do you know the song called Am I Dreaming by Aesop?
Yes. Yep.
So it starts with this great entry of violins, and then you feel empowered. And then the song goes something of the sort like, I'm not done fighting. I don't feel I've lost. Am I dreaming? Is there more like us? Got me feeling like it's all too much. I feel beaten, but I can't give up. I'm still fighting. And that's the way the song goes. And the violin continues to go on. So you can't help but feel good with that.
Absolutely. And Dr. Alvarez, I love the association, right? I am not done fighting. And when you hear that phrase, I'm not done fighting. I'm still fighting. I might feel beating up, but I'm still fighting, right? I think there is that alignment in education, right? That as leaders, there are many different, I like to say, insidious variables that we're dealing with in education that we have to continue to fight, that we have to continue to combat. I always like to say in my keynote speeches, we want to be able to move our students from the mountaintop to the promised land, right? But we have to keep fighting to move our students to this promised land. And as, again, like I said, these insidious variables, access gaps, opportunity gaps that we see, down to its isolated threats, we have to still keep fighting. And Dr. Alvarez, I look, knowing your work personally, yes, you still keep fighting. I want to stay out of your way.
I, you know, as long as I'm not alone, you know, I could be a warrior, but I need other warriors
Absolutely.
with me. So
Absolutely.
we have so much to deal with in regards to after COVID. I mean, there's just so much that's been told to us about COVID was trying to give us a lesson, like we need to change education, but it's like a rubber band, like people can't seem to let go of old habits. And
Yes.
then it just goes back to the way it was before. And you have to keep fighting, saying, no, it needs to change. It needs to be different. And COVID has taught us that we can do this. I mean, look how quickly we were able to change education just with a few weeks. We didn't have a lot. Otherwise, it would have taken years if, because we would be like, oh, let's think about it. And we'd be really slow about it.
And Dr. Alper is completely true, right? And old habits. I always like to equate old habits with the essential question of how do we continuously challenge and change the status quo when we know it becomes difficult, when we have to apply that systems to thinking that Daniel Kahneman talks about. We revert back to what I like to say, the complicit practice, the old practices. But again, I think this acceleration of technology, AI, has put us in an inevitable situation where now there's that creative tension between old habits versus the revolutionary practices. But I want to get down to another issue that you and I believe in at the staunch level, right? Where we have to continue to fight, where we have to continue to stand up. And this continuously beat up educators, right? When we talk about these two E words, excellence and equity. Now, I want you, Dr. Alvarez, because again, your definition of excellence and equity, specifically in context of application and practice, is duly noted in Forest Park, right? But can you define excellence and equity in the context of the work that is being underpinned in Forest Park? That's the first part. The second part are, for my audience is, what are some universal strategies that can be applied at any level, any tiers within the education ecosystem, both from a state and a national lens? How can we deepen that work around gender equity? That's one that we need to really look at, of how we can get more women in executive and leadership roles in education, where now we see that parity.
Sure. So coming into Forest Park, I'm now going into my fourth year. Equity work was about to start here with the National Equity Project. And one of the first things that Forest Park was dealing with is just the definition of equity and what it stands for, and everyone coming up with a common understanding of what equity means. And really pulling out equality as well, because they were confusing the two, equality and equity. That was the first starts coming in there. However, one of the other challenges, and I don't think I'm alone on this, is that my district was majority white teachers, and my student body was majority black students. And when you have that, people are going to say like, yep, I'm providing, high expectations for my children. I'm providing equity for my children. But in all honesty, it was not there until, you actually started, explaining to them like, windows and mirrors and what that stands for. Like really looking at yourself and having a self-reflection, like, do I really understand what equity is? Am I really anti-racist? Do I check myself? when I'm finding myself hitting some biases? Am I able to look out the window and see the differences and understand the differences? Or am I truly colorblind and feeling proud about being colorblind? And so coming into Forest Park, having to talk about that with
Yeah.
majority white staff is not easy. And especially not easy because I'm a woman of color. And I've said this many times, saying we are black and brown folks, we could go ahead and talk as much as we want about equity and injustice. And unfortunately, most of our white colleagues think, well, that's the job. That's your job to do, not our job to do. And that's where the frustration comes in, because we know how to do that fight. And we need our white allies to back us up and start stepping up and doing the work. And when they ask, like, well, how do we do the work? You know how to do the work. Everyone knows how to do the work. And it was interesting because this past weekend I had a conversation with Dr. Patina Love, and we were talking about that. And she said it so nicely. She's like, do you know how to be nice to people? Do you know how to be understanding to people? Do you know how to care for people? That's equity right there. And if you don't know how to do that, you're saying that you don't know how to be a nice person. And that's basically what we're saying here. So the National Equity Project was something that was already here. Our principals were going through their own kind of windows and mirrors and understanding. It took them a while to really understand bias, because unfortunately, anytime you talk about racism, there's like this wall that's right away put through, like, not me, not me. And they're becoming very defensive. But when you finally start explaining to them, like, some people don't intentionally want to be bad or be unkind. It's what we live and breathe every day. Racism is just, we're living and breathing it. And unfortunately, even people of color, we fall into that trap. And we're doing things that are not equitable. And that's where we need to say, oh, that was a bias. And where did it come from? Did it come from home? Did it come from my learning at school, the different institutions? Did it come from just wanting to belong into a group, particularly white society, that this came about because you want to fit in so badly? And so that was something that my principals had to really look within themselves and understand, like, this work, as we continue to do this work, is not easy. It's uncomfortable. It makes us feel uneasy. And just to remind them of that all the time, like, if you're feeling kind of icky still, you're feeling like, oh, I really don't want to feel this way because you're finally uncovering yourself, then we're doing the work right. But then the other part was working with my staff. And so we hired Be Well. Ashley is the CEO, and she does a phenomenal job with it. But it when you're doing equity work, when you're doing race, social justice, inclusion, you can't give it 30 minutes, you know? It just doesn't work that way.
Dr. Alvarez, I have been doing VFE for 2 years, and this is a very subjective statement. That is the best one-liner around equity work I have ever heard. And it is, but it's true. Please continue. Please continue.
It's absolutely true. And the thing is, you can't do it in 30 minutes. This is work that happens every single day. It happens in the work we do. And so poor Ashley, like, you give her these 30 minutes. This is you who are doing equity. No. And her and I would have conversations. I'm like, we cannot do this way. So we're continuing on with our journey. This journey goes on for a long time. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that looking at data. So
Yes.
coming here, the data was attendance, and obviously our achievement scores, but it was kind of all bulked together. Now, explain this to me. You have a majority black district, and it's your black students that are doing the poorest. Explain that to me. I can't
You're
wrap my mind around it.
right.
I'm like, how is that possible? That's to me, it just like I'm still not understanding it. We're working on it. We're growing.
Yeah.
Our growth scores have grown every single year for 4 years.
Absolutely.
Our proficiency is rising, but it should have never been that way. So don't tell me we were doing equity work before. The data is right there, and it proves to you that we weren't. When you see our unhoused children doing poorly, when you see our black students, and when you see our male students, when you see, like, let's look at the data for what it is. And that, the first time they got to see it, a lot of people were like really swallowing hard. And also, some people literally said, "You're trying to shame us." They used those words. And I said, "Oh, I can't shame you, because that's a personal feeling. Shame is a personal feeling. That doesn't come from me. I can't shame you unless you gave me the power." And for you to say those words, that's something internal that you yourself are feeling shameful about. And
Absolutely.
honestly, we should feel shameful that we have, did an injustice to our children.
And
I
Dr.
think I
Alvarez,
think yeah, go ahead.
and no, this is great because I again, this is an interactive podcast and I have so much to say about your answer, but I want to go back to a statement, right? And that you stated, and just to expand on this, because you hear this when you present the data in an objective form to saying this is our current reality, and this is the work that we need to do to eradicate our current reality so that we can be able to ensure that it's that level of equity for all, right? Equity for all. Why is it, Dr. Alvarez, that when there's an objective presentation of where we're at from a current state as a learning organization, specifically looking at historically excluded student groups, why could there be that misnomer that the presentation of the data could be shaming individuals as opposed to here's our current reality, the truth, and how we're going to be able to rectify some of these core gap areas, specifically regarding our historically excluded student groups?
So the first thing that comes to mind is data was never really looked at before, nor was part of their practices. And so when you're not having that as part of your practices for a reason, and let me just put it out there, there's a reason it wasn't. Then once it's being out there, like you're really unfortunately being more, not fortunately. Not unfortunately, but fortunately, being transparent finally, there are no excuses now. And because now you're putting it out there, your families now see it, and your families are going to keep you accountable for it. And
Absolutely.
so when that happens, the school district now has to answer to that, including myself, because I inherited it, because now it's my data. So I have to call it out for what it is and not hide, like be the Wizard of Oz behind a curtain kind of thing. No, you need to bring it out to everyone and say, this is how we're going to do it. Because when you tell people this is your data, this is our data, and this is how we're going to make it to grow and be better educators, the accountability comes in and now you have to do it.
Absolutely.
And so
Absolutely.
accountability, even though that too is like a nasty word for some people,
Right.
a lot of people love it because that's what they've been craving for. And when you don't have that, that's why other people feel like, well, I could do whatever I want, and unfortunately, do an injustice to our children, to our scholars.
Absolutely.
That's why it's so important to look at that data and say, now let's truly look deep into it. How are our, children with IEPs doing? How are our children who are emergent bilinguals doing? How and then when you see our white students in 80th, 90th percentile, and they represent only maybe 20% of your population, something's not right. You know,
Absolutely.
the math ain't
Absolutely.
mathing.
You are absolutely right, Dr. Alvarez. And to my listeners and viewers of VFB, this is one of those answers. Dr. Alvarez, we use this as an asynchronous professional learning tool, a mechanism to be able to go back with specific answers, sentiments, unpack it, interrogate it, align it to specific evidence or theory that is out there. But Dr. Alvarez, your answer is what I would like to, what I like to say, a 400 level doctoral presentation of equity, data, accountability, and how to strategically interrogate data with descriptive questions so that the work continues, but make people think about it. Intentional cognitive dissonance in the context of how we can
Yeah.
improve our
I was
And
going to add one more thing with it, if you don't mind.
yeah,
The other
please, Doc.
part of equity is that you have to talk to your students.
Yes.
And you need their voice, and they're the ones who are going to tell you what they see and what they need. And so prior to that, we were talking about how we get into this rut of going back to like that rubber band feeling of education. And I think
Yeah.
it's because after you're in the system for so long, and I go back to that, like you get stuck in it.
Yeah.
And the way not to get stuck in it is talk to your young scholars, because they haven't been in that loop. They're trying to change it as much as possible. And they're like, we need this, we need that. And one of the things they told me when I was talking to them, they said, we really want teachers that look like us. And I wanted to be very clear with them, like, I can't go just go ahead and fire my teachers, especially if they're good teachers, you know. So I wanted them to understand that. But once positions started opening, we're going to be a little bit more intentional. And what I mean
Absolutely.
by a little bit more intentional is the hiring process needs to change. And that means all the questions need to be the same for all our candidates. How we look at all the resumes needs to be the same as well, what we're looking for. And then the people on the hiring, there has to be people of color on the hiring,
Absolutely.
the panel. And if you do not have those people, there are districts around me that you could say, I need your help. I need you to help me interview for this position here. Because bottom line, and I say this all the time, my children are their children are my children, no
Absolutely.
matter what. So
Absolutely.
me helping them and they help me, we're really just helping all of our children here. So
Absolutely.
I say this all the time, don't give me the excuse, but we don't have a black teacher. We don't have a Latina. We don't have, they're out there. You're just not looking. So there's no
Absolutely.
excuses for that. So the hiring process needs to change, make it more, and that's when you make it more diverse. Our district office has become much more diverse now. Used to be all white, no longer like that anymore. Our teachers that we've been hiring have also been teachers of color, having some difficulty because, other teachers feel threatened, and I get that. But the other teachers that are not feeling threatened and feeling like, you know what, I'm going to learn, I'm going to get better because of our new folks, we're better for it.
Absolutely. And Dr. Alvarez, I want to thank you because, again, to my audience, to my listeners and viewers, Dr. Alvarez is one of the equity national experts with regards to systems change, cultural change, mindset, collective shared mental model change around excellence and equity. And at the outset of Dr. Alvarez sentiment, and I think we still need, even though it's rudimentary, we still need to explore the differences between equality and equity. And Dr. Alvarez, I want to get into this because you highlighted this in your last answer. And I just released new research called the Inclusive Triangle for Holistic Innovation. In essence, Dr. Alvarez, you put in such a great practical term of getting our families and students, their voice being a part of the design process, right? So the Inclusive Triangle is anchored by students, but families and communities are working together on behalf of the students to create learning ecosystems of the 22nd century in the AAC stage of education. Now, Dr. Alvarez, you have this intentional focus of including the voices of our students and our families. When I think about it, in every other industry, before a product or a prototype leaves beta stage, they always get the feedback from the users, the end users, which are the customers. We need to emulate that practice too in education, where we get the feedback from our end users, our most important customers, families, and students. Mm-hmm. A part of your strategic plan, you have always done this throughout your career, but focusing on Forest Park, part of your SOP, you root families and community engagement as a priority, mm-hmm. as a priority to accelerate the goals and the strategic imperatives. Now, with regards to inclusivity, right, how do we incorporate the voices that are usually disenfranchised in education, families, mm-hmm. communities, and students, into this new vision of education?
So first, I'm a true believer that you cannot provide a learning of belonging without partnering with families. You just mm-hmm. can't. So one of the first things I did was I hired a director of engagement, phenomenal woman, made a huge difference in regards to how we are working with our families. We had separate parent organizations in each of our schools, which mm-hmm. it ended up being like competition. It also ended up being like a divide, particularly if there were more white people living in one side of the bridge that we have versus on the other side where there are our Black families. And so there was a huge divide for that. And so we decided we were just going to have one parent teacher organization. And it took us 2 years to do that. We do have that. That was one of our goals in our strategic plan, to make sure that occurred, to make sure that all of our schools know what's happening within our families and they're saying the same language, speaking the same language. Although within each school, I mean, obviously they have their own things that are happening, but when it came to the district, that was all common language. And so when they sent out their newsletters, that needed to be the same. Right. We also had town halls that we called harvest time, so that we could really harvest some really good conversation with our families to get feedback on particular mm-hmm. subjects, things that they're looking for, even when they're upset at me. I'll give you a good example. We had Spanish in the middle school. My first year, I kind of observed it all. The Spanish that I saw, like if I walk into a Spanish classroom and I speak Spanish, I want to hear Spanish. Mm-hmm. I don't want to see coloring. I don't mm-hmm. want to, you know, that kind of stuff is what I was seeing, and I heard English. And so mm-hmm. I walk into a classroom, I'm speaking Spanish, and all the kids are looking at me like, we have no idea what you're talking about, lady. I was like, okay. What we need to do is start from our primary and start it with our kindergarten. So moved Spanish to the primary and then build it up till we get to our middle school. My families were not happy about that. They were like, you took away Spanish from our middle schoolers. And in all honesty, they weren't getting anything. They really weren't getting any Spanish. And I said, unfortunately, yes, my children are in the middle school are not going to get Spanish for the next year. But they will the following year as we grow Spanish. And to me, I just had to eat that up. I knew they were going to be mad. Mm-hmm. So, but mm-hmm. I had to have an explanation and a why behind it to say, unfortunately, my children in the middle school will lose out, maybe even from a couple of words. But honestly, I don't even know how many of them would have been able to just order food in a Mexican restaurant based on what I was hearing. And that's as basic as you could get, you know, going to a Mexican restaurant and ordering food. So that's just one there. The other thing we have is called a citizen advisory group or mm-hmm. board. And they they meet monthly, and talk about monthly things that are coming up and how to really engage families. And they also provide feedback to the board. As a matter of fact, our very last board meeting, they did a presentation of start, stop, continue for the district, and what we should start, what we should stop, and what we should continue. And that's, if anyone wants to watch it, it's in our board meeting for June. The presentation is there.
That's
And
great.
they just provide like positive things, and they also give us areas of growth. They share other information that perhaps we're not thinking about that families bring to it. They are in charge of our parent caregiver handbook.
That's
So
great.
it's our parents developing that.
Yeah.
With our director of engagement and my secretary, they work together with our families. And then I then look at it after they give all their feedback. And I start doing my feedback and then provide it to the board. So there's a lot of things that have changed in regards to our families. Even the way we notify them, we have something called rooms, where teachers can send pictures, notify them on the minute of what is occurring. Newsletters go out every week to our families. They're invited to a lot of different things. One of my proudest ones was the Black History Museum that we did. Our children developed that. And then our families actually got to ask a lot of questions to our children. It was something they'd never done before and something that needed to be done, especially learning about Black excellence. Our children didn't get that before. They're getting it now. And that was something our families immediately saw a difference because they've been asking for it. And here it is now. Now we need to show that we're doing it as well. And that's why we did the museum so that our children can show off what they've learned, but also their talent, just highlighting and celebrating Black excellence altogether.
Amazing. Thank you, Dr. Alvarez, for now, this is just a personal response. Thank you for the work that you're doing to include families and students, because that's near and dear to my heart, right? Because one of those, as I was growing up, one of those disenfranchised family members of mine was my mother, who was advocating for me consistently. So I had the necessary rigor within my academic programming. But as you made that shift with Spanish, right? And as a former superintendent, there were some decisions, right, academic or instructional related, that is, I would say, not the most popular. But I always go back to this one liner, this one phrase, right? What is best for kids? Obsolete of adults, obsolete of creating an adult-centric operating model, right? What is best for kids? And sometimes the decision that is best for kids, it is not, it doesn't sit right with adults, right? But we're in a kid business, I always say. And the decisions that we make for kids, sometimes we as adults are not going to like, but it's going to benefit the people that are in front of us. And another thing, wow, this citizen advisory board, the museum, the rooms for notification, transparency. I love the aspect of the start, stop, and continue, where the community is providing you and the board different ideas of what's working, what's not working, and what to deepen and strengthen based off of the SOP. Thank you for that, Dr. Alvarez,
No
for
problem.
your work and intentionality with that. But I want to highlight your work. Something that came out a few weeks ago. Yay! Welcome to the
Oh,
club. Welcome to the club, Dr.
thank
Alvarez.
you. Thank
Dr.
you.
Elizabeth Alvarez, to my audience, just released a book. Yes, she joined the
Oh,
Authors Club. And
great.
congratulations on that milestone. It is such a your contribution is going to continue to strengthen the work in the education field. To my audience, Dr. Alvarez's book, please get it. She's going to tell you where it's available. The name of the title is Rabbit on the Moon: Embracing My Mexican American Identity. Please go on. Is it available on Amazon, Dr.
It
Alvarez?
is. It
Yes,
is.
go on Amazon and get it, everybody. Yes, get it. It is such a good book. But Dr. Alvarez, for my listeners and for my audience, right? What was the motivation of the title? That title is really compelling. And what are the core themes of the book that can be applied for a personal or leadership development context to my listeners and viewers?
Sure. So there's a reason for the title, Rabbit on the Moon. I'll explain that in a second. I think the second part of embracing my Mexican American identity speaks for itself. But I was motivated by truly a deep desire to explore and share my journey of belonging and also acceptance. So my life, marked by pivotal events, provided the perfect narrative to discuss themes of teaching, learning, identity, and storytelling. That's where Rabbit on the Moon comes in. It is a story. It's a folk story written. It's a Mexican folk story. I know there's others that come around. If you look up Rabbit on the Moon, there's other ones, but I believe it's Rabbit in the Moon versus on the Moon. And it was a story that a child shared with me as I was a teacher, and taught him the phases of the moon. And so it was a part of me saying, hey, let's not talk about stories and let's just go really into concepts and ideas about science, dismissing the story altogether and also dismissing my own heritage, my own lineage of being Mexican, Mexican American, born in the United States, and kind of like repressing who I was because of trying to belong and trying to be in a world of white society. And also my language was taken away from me too because I learned English first, and that was something my parents chose because they wanted me to really fit in. And that wasn't going to change anything. My brown skin is going to give it away no matter what. So, yeah, I mean, you can't help. I joke about this all the time. I go to certain places. I am not kidding. Grocery stores, malls, and there are people who don't even speak Spanish to try to speak Spanish to me. And I immediately am like, do I go ahead and speak Spanish back to them, see if they really know the language? Or do I say I speak English? But it's absolutely true. You look at me, you're like, oh, she must speak Spanish, which I do now. So my path to becoming a teacher was not just about imparting knowledge, but about engaging in a mutual learning experience with my students, which also was reciprocal. Like this dynamic highlighted the importance of creating a learning environment. It was like this exchange of ideas. And growth. And then eventually I became an administrator, lo and behold, going into assistant principal to principal to a chief of schools in Chicago Public Schools. And then here I am now as a superintendent. I would have never thought that. But, and then there's very few of us, Latinas, which is why I happen to know my Latina superintendents out there. Because there's so few of us, there's not many of us, and the story just really talks about like you earned a title, that noble title of teacher or educator, when your students really learn. Because you could teach all you want, that doesn't mean our students are learning. And that really, I mean, it goes back to like going to the Spanish. Like, are we going to be really giving mediocre stuff to our children? And when we think about standards. Is the standard we're giving to our children going to be the high bar or the low bar to it? Really involves learning from our students as much as is learning from us. Another significant motivation was to address the impact of societal stereotypes on identity and academic success. It talks about the genuine caring in education. Not the subjective schooling that Valenzuela talks about, because a teacher could really subtract the schooling from you and make you feel very belittled. And when you do that, then all of a sudden what you're doing is taking the spirit and the energy away from the curiosity, the imagination, the want to learn. And so a nurturing environment where students feel valued, where storytelling and performance emerged and provided this transformation, and also using it as a tool for learning. So the book goes really deep into that. And so it really came out of that fable, the rabbit on the moon. It became my muse. It encouraged me. I really wanted to talk about like that cultural background that really made the book altogether. So there's some really deep personal stories I share in there about my teaching, about my students. And then I also dedicated the book to a professor of mine who was my very first teacher of color, and I had him when I was working on my PhD. That's how long it took.
Same with me, Dr. Alvarez. Same with me. First person of color that I had as a teacher was in my master's program.
And I was glad it was in my higher ed, I will tell you that much. But he was so significant to me, and he was one of the first to read my drafts, and he said, "This, you need to make this into a book." So back in 2019, I was finishing up the book, and I literally was in China finishing up the book in the airplane. And then he passed away in November of 2019. And when I came back to the States, 2020 happened, and everything closed down. I lost the thumb drive it was in. I was deeply depressed about losing him. And then I was feeling sick. I was diagnosed with cancer. And then all of this was happening in 2020. So I forgot about the book totally. And, it went into survival mode, literally. And also with my family is making sure, because we lost the personal touch when we went. And I was working with Latino families. And I think you could understand this. Like we're huggers. We're like we're just like communal. We want to be amongst one another. And when that was taken away, the videos that I mean that I was doing, these Zooms that I was doing with my families, you could see it. You could see the hurt in their faces and the boxes. So that was happening all through 2020. And so the thumb drive was lost. The book was put aside. And then I then came back to it. Last year, I want to say it was, and I started retyping it, going back and typing what I had. I'm sure there's some stuff that were missed out because I couldn't find a thumb drive. I still have it's I'm gonna find it one day. And all those parts I didn't have, maybe it'll be a second book, but that I missed out on. But I'm like, okay, it's time now. It's time now to release it. And so I dedicated a section there for Dr. Gallegos. Because it was really him that said this needs to be published.
Amazing.
And now it's out there. So his spirit's with me always.
Dr. Alvarez, thank you for your contribution to the education field because your book, it talks about culture, it talks about personal, how to deal with or deal with personal adversity around this whole identity focus and just instruction of raising student achievement by, acknowledging the identity and being inclusive of our students as well, welcoming them, right? When I hear stories, Dr. Alvarez, that people have to use their home dialect, their home language, just to assimilate into the mainstream of this country, that's sad because nobody should lose their home identity or culture. That's what makes this country rich, right? Is the diversity and the inclusiveness of a variety of different ethnic cultures and backgrounds. But thank you for your contribution. I love what you said, the journey of belonging. And I think that we still, even our students, but us as adults too, this journey of belonging, going back to this whole hiring practices of when we find teachers of color, Black and brown teachers, how do we ensure that there's that level or that culture of belonging as well with our students? But thank you for your contributions with the book. Please, to my audience, make sure that you get it. Again, I'm a huge Dr. Elizabeth Alvarez fan. So make sure Rabbit, not Rabbit in the Moon, Rabbit on the Moon, Embracing My Mexican American Identity. And Dr. Alvarez, I want to talk about your state and your national work, right? This is kind of like a shift. As the past president of the Illinois ALAS, which is the Association of Latino Superintendents and Administrators, for my viewers and listeners out there, you engage in many national state discussions, right? What I love about you, Dr. Alvarez, you epitomize the three words of my book: intentional, bold, and unapologetic. And you're bringing those conversations at the state and national level. But when we talk about policy adoption and modification, curriculum restructuring to be more culture responsive, and access with regards to what you were talking about, improving pedagogy for the quality of all. But when we look at policy discussions that remain steadfast in the AC stage of education, now, how are you leading, Dr. Alvarez, local and state discussions regarding transformation and policy development around artificial intelligence integration? Specifically, when I talk about AI, AI and equity, I like to use those words, AI, equity, and excellence for triangulation, but specifically developing leadership capacity with underscoring AI as a strategic lever for the 22nd century. How do we do that for Generation Z and Generation Alpha? And what are some of the discussions you're having?
So I've had several discussions, like I've worked with other boards to let them know that we started a generative AI policy. I also want to let them know that AI has been out here for some time. I mean, there's spell check that was out there. So I don't want people to get confused because generative AI is very, very different. My generative AI actually knows me by name. And actually says Dr. Alvarez, and asked me to call it Alex. I'm gonna say it because I don't want to put a pronoun, because I know y Alex, you're not human. You are not human.
What would be
but
the
this is
what? And you know what, Dr. Alvarez, that is great, because what would be the pronouns for the AI? We got to come up with something like that. It. I love that, right? This
it's it.
it.
It's it. It's like my cousin it. But so one of the things we for a generative AI is that we know in November of 2022 was the first time everybody would starts talking about it. So December of 2022, I started talking about it, saying we got to jump on this, we got to do something about this, and spoke to our policy committee and said we eventually need to start bringing this out to our staff and to ourselves because it's going to happen no matter what. We also read a book, The Coming Wave, The Coming Wave. And basically it's saying that this is not coming slowly. It's like a tsunami, you know, so the coming wave is here. So the entire district level, we read the book, The Coming Wave, and we decided we're going to make a policy. And so we started drafting what we wanted from the policy. We got it approved sometime like around probably right before the summer started in 2023. And then the fall of 2023, we then started getting feedback from our staff, from the district level, from families, so that we could really adjust it. We got feedback from our board lawyer as well. I started partnering with MIT and UIC. MIT helped us create a 4-week curriculum for our 8th graders. The 4-week curriculum talks about just the ethics of AI. It talks about things that you need to be cautious with AI because it can hallucinate, the different language models that are out there, understanding that sometimes the different language models compete with one another and then will create something totally different. Understand that what is what AI is grabbing from is just from the World Wide Web, and that most of that's what's in there is coming from white males, so it could be very biased. And so this was part of the curriculum. And then we also wanted them to start thinking about what are jobs that we're not thinking about in the future that AI can be part of and may be part of something that our children might be thinking about in the future. So that's just, it's a 4-week curriculum that MIT helped us build. We
That's
also
great.
got robots from UIC where our children would code and work with the robots with AI to read a book. And then they would take their robot friend and they would take it to the primary level and they would read the book to the primary level. But then our little first, second, third graders can go ahead and ask the robot questions about the book and the robot would respond. So it's a one way of letting them know, like, this is how to do it. We also traveled to California because California was doing some remarkable things in education because education was so far behind. And so I went to California to visit some of my friends, and you know who they are, and to ask them questions. Jerry Almendarez was one of the biggest ones who helped me out.
Absolutely.
And
Jerry's
he's awesome. And then he, so while we were in California, I sat in a panel of students talking about AI and basically saying the reason why they like AI is because it is freeing up our teachers to start developing relationships with them. Wherein before, teachers are so bogged down with developing lessons and grading that now they're getting more attention because AI is their assistant. You know, Alex is there to support. And now relationships are being built. And so when that was said by the students, and because of my whole thing about belonging, the relationship part really sold me. And don't get me wrong, because if you read The Coming Wave and you speak to other people, people are still scared and they're still talking about cheating and what AI can do. But if you're scared of it, then that means you need to just change the curriculum. So you can't be saying you're going to do a book report, you know, a boring book report on Rabbit on the Moon. You know, instead, like, how are you going to change that curriculum so that children are having that productive struggle still, and children are really having, you know, the curiosity and the thinking and, you know, to move forward with it. So that's on us as educators to not fall back that rubber band again. So we're doing full circle, the rubber band again, to do the same old, same old, because AI is telling us you can't do it that way. So we looked at our laws. We have SOPA in Illinois, so our student protection laws. We literally were looking at our policy that wasn't written yet to see if, you know, if they have it there. Now they have it. There's policy now in Illinois that has the generative AI, but we had already developed it. And then we went through a second approval of our board, because now we had everyone's feedback, and we also included our students in their 13 years and older to be part of it. Now, this is what something I want you to understand. Our students and our aspiring first graders are graduating 2035. All they will know is AI.
Correct.
These are our babies going into first grade now. They were our kindergartners before. They are the class of 2035, and that's all they're going to know. And so they're going to really depend on us to really guide that way. And we could really botch it up, or we could do a really good job with it. I mean, we've botched up a lot when it came to education, believe me. That doesn't mean we can't fix it.
Absolutely. And Dr. Alvarez, you have me, wow. I'm actually, as you're going through this, I'm referencing different stuff. You have me thinking, right? Because When I think about AI, and especially artificial intelligence, now this ASI, artificial superintelligence, generative AI, looking at these language models, the development of it, again, goes back to this level of AI ethics, right? AI ethics to ensure that the the tools, the generative components or features that we're integrating into our standard operating model, the old way, you know, that there's synergy within that. We have to take in consideration with that. But also, too, there's that level of AI readiness within all the tiers of the learning ecosystem. Love what you stated. And I think that this is becoming, I like to say, the inevitable, the coming wave is Generation Alpha, right? Generation Alpha. And Generation Alpha, they are the generative natives of of all the generations. And exactly what you stated, only thing they know is around AI, generative AI. You're talking about that interaction with AI, which is another strategic component to help students from an instructional standpoint. That is so important. But you are right, Dr. Alvarez. The definition of AI has been around since 1956. John McCarthy contextualized it. AI, not in definition, but AI was pretty much the invention of it, came in 1950. Education really hasn't talked about AI to 2022. You're absolutely right with that, Dr. Alvarez. And do you see, and this is kind of a subvariant question, do you see a lot of the policy language and structure changing rapidly because of AI and generative
I know.
platforms and components are changing?
I put on our policy that this is going to be changing as much as, you know, whenever there's changes in it. I mean, now I look at our policy now, and this was just changed. It got approved 2 months ago. I'm like, now we're going to need to change it again, but I'm not ready to change it until more new stuff comes in. I mean, it's just like buying a new computer, or, you know, as soon as you buy it, it's old. So
So
it's just old now, but yeah, you can't keep up. That's why it's the tsunami, and that's why I know my policy now is gotten old just in within the 2 months for the things that are changing.
and you know what, Dr. Alvarez, the and because of the reactivity, the velocity of change and evolution with AI, the more sophisticated the data sets become, you're going to start seeing
Oh, it's
everything become
learning so
outdated.
much from us. Everything that we're
Absolutely.
putting in it's learning so much and changing. I mean, the fact that when Alex finally came out and said, "How's it going, Dr. Alvarez?" I was like, "That's how fast it's changing." So,
Super algorithms. Yeah. I mean, machine
yeah,
learning.
all immediately. I mean, and think about all the misinformation that's being put into it. So that's why we need to be very careful and remind ourselves that we are human, and we are the humans, and don't forget that human aspect
Absolutely.
as we're working with AI, not just to leave it to, you know, Alex to do it all.
You're right. Dr.
I mean,
Alfred.
I think of it like, you know, when they discovered fire. Prior to discovering fire, our brains were different, and then all of a sudden fire came about. We're able to cook differently and eating meat that was no longer raw. And then all of a sudden our brains changed because of it. That's the same thing with our children. Like we're not going back, you know? And so we have to understand that portion of it, that we're different now. This is a little bit different than fire, obviously, because I think this is a little bit more crazier.
And you talk about that equilibrium that is so important. You're right. Human intelligence and artificial intelligence. I always like to say, and it goes back to a course that I took a while ago, is finding that equilibrium between humans and machines. Dr. Alvarez, last question. You've made it through VFE. This has been such a fun conversation. But the one liner I'm going to take with me, not the three words you're about to say, but the one liner, equity can't be done in 30 minutes. I love that. Yes, I'm going to say that. But last question, Dr. Alvarez, for my audience, for VFB, as we're concluding this episode, what three words do you want today's audience to leave our podcast regarding innovation, equity, and excellence in the AC stage of education?
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about everything we just spoke about. So my first word is empowerment. And then just really making sure we're moving forward in education, empowering others, giving them the feeling that they are enough, and there's so much possibility. My second word is transformation. COVID-19 provided that for us, for our educators. It was a world, a lesson to our world, not to go back. We spoke about the rubber band. And then inclusivity.
Yes.
There's diversity, there's equity, but those buzzwords won't happen without inclusivity.
Absolutely.
And that's the only way, bringing everyone to the table, especially those that may think or look differently than you. So I'm
Empowerment,
looking.
transformation, inclusivity. Thank you, Dr. Alvarez, for coming on VFE. I am sure there are going to be individuals from my audience and my viewers that want to reach out to you, really want to expand on your knowledge and expertise, specifically around how do we create inclusive, equitable, excellent learning environments that are empowering for all. How would they be able to reach out to you, Dr. Alvarez, or get in contact with you?
So there's two separate ways. So you could find me on LinkedIn. It's under Elizabeth Alvarez, just like my name says there, PhD. You'll find me that way, or you could find me through X, formerly Twitter.
I laugh when Dr. Alvarez, I laugh when anybody says X, formerly known as Twitter. I just laugh at it.
What are you gonna do?
Right.
You could find me there at E Alvarez D91. And those are two different ways. Obviously, you could find me on my website at Forest Park District 91. There's an email there as well if you truly need to reach out to me that way. But I respond back through LinkedIn and through my ex Twitter.
Absolutely. You're excellent, right? Dr. Elizabeth Alvarez, thank you for coming on Voices for Excellence. It was such an honor to talk to you. I can't wait till I know we got a meeting like this week or next week or something
I
for
think it's this week.
LDCMA. It's like next week. I'll see you soon, good or sister. Amana,
Yes.
thank you so much. Listen,
Thank
I love the
you.
work that you're doing. Keep on for our kids and families.
All right. Thank you so much, Dr. Connor.
Thank you so much. And on that note, onward and upward, have a great evening.